culture to politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. Another great day for the stock market. Wow. The Dow Jones Industrial Average's market just closed moments ago. Up 553 points. That's 2 days in a row with 500-point plus gains. So what's causing that? Maybe, just maybe, optimism that these reopenings of various states may be allowed to continue and our economy can begin coming back. But that's not the only measure of personal success. In fact, for most people, it's not the most important measure of personal success. That's one of the themes of a book that has become a gigantic bestseller. It is available everywhere and particularly appropriate for the COVID-19 crisis. The book is called The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. And David Brooks is the author, the very well-known columnist, one of America's leading journalists. His columns are read regularly in the New York Times and all over the world. David, congratulations on the success of your book. And did you secretly know we were going to be having some life-threatening pandemic that was going to paralyze everything and give a whole second life to the second mountain?
Yeah, somehow I didn't know that. But it turns out, you know, the book is about how to go through hard times in life and emerge better. And now the whole world is sort of doing that all at once. So it does seem germane.
Oh, it's highly germane. I mean, it's almost prophetic in that regard. So we'll say the record shows that you were not together with Bill Gates and Anthony Fauci in planning this entire disaster. You haven't seen Plandemic, have you?
I have not seen it. I'm successfully left out of all conspiracies.
Well, good. I'm glad. I hope that continues. What has surprised you most in the context of your book, The Second Mountain, which is posted at our website at michaelmedved.com? What has surprised you most in a positive way about the national response to this disaster?
Yeah, when I was looking at this through the lens of social trust, do we trust each other? Would we show up for each other's lives? And it was sort of like watching, you know, Lord of the Rings, one of the big battles of distrust versus trust. And you could tell a story that we're a divided society, there's a lot of animosity, that this thing would just break us. And if you look at the history of pandemics in the past, that sort of is what's happened. You look at the diarists in England in the 1660s when they had a pandemic, or the bubonic plague, or 1918. Everyone talks about family members giving up on each other, intense suspicion of outsiders, just a breakdown of social fabric. But my general sense is that that has not happened, that we have shown up for each other by and large, especially on the local level, and that we've not only seen the healthcare workers and the grocery workers, but we've also just seen people down the block and restaurants, small businesses showing up for each other. And I've just been on the phone with a bunch of pollsters and asked them, how do people feel right now? And the answer is, first, they feel anxious and stressed, and that's to be expected. But they also feel pretty good about how the people around them have behaved, and they feel they've got to know each other, especially dads. Like 60% of dads say, I know my kids better than I did. I'm listening to them more. They feel tighter as families by and large. They feel, I got to know my neighbors. I hear a lot of people saying, you know, when this is over, I don't want to go back to the rat race. So there's been a shift in values. So I feel much more upbeat about how regular Americans have behaved than I might have.
Yeah, I share that. And have you been sheltering at home? You been... And right now, are you also limited social contacts, no guests for dinner, that kind of thing?
Yeah, we've been doing all that. In fact, on the rare occasion when I go out and I put a wallet in my back pocket, I think, wow, wallets are really uncomfortable. Because most days I don't put a wallet in, you know, so and you know, the job we do, especially, you know, me, I'm a writer, so it ain't that different. And I was on the phone with a friend of mine who's a farmer. He said, yeah, staying on my property, working my fields, having dinner with my family at home, this is just life for me every day. So some people have their lives totally disrupted if they're social extroverts out there. And some of us, working at home is not a new thing.
Well, the hardest thing for us, and I have two hard things. I mean, we were unable to hold and cuddle our grandchildren. And that's very difficult. We see them, but it's my wife describes it, it's like Romeo and Juliet, because it's a balcony scene. They come up to an upper deck, and we're down below, more than 6 feet apart. And we wave, and we talk with them the way you can talk with like a 1.5-year-old and a 3-year-old. The other thing, and it's something that you describe in your book, and that's why I brought it up, is we, as I think you know, David, used to do big Sabbath and holiday meals all the time. We always had 12 guests at our table, sometimes both Friday night and Saturday, and lots of people. And that's like completely gone. It seems like a distant memory. It is learning a different form of religiosity, which you write about in your book, The Second Mountain, when people are unable to congregate for shared food fellowship in person. Don't you think?
Yeah, and that is hard, and everyone's doing, you know, Zoom seders or online virtual church services. Though I find a lot of the people I found in my networks, whether their synagogues are sort of more central hubs to their life than they were before, that they're super high attendance in a lot of the online sermons, the online meetings, the Zoom Bible study, Torah study, that in my view, churches and synagogues have stepped up. And so I do feel they feel connected, but it's still not the same. And one of the things that is true in all faiths, especially true in Judaism, is ritual is so important, that most of what you do is a physical ritual, and the rituals mark something, the lighting of candles or whatever, the washing of hands, and they mark transition moments in life. And when you're on Zoom, you can't do ritual that much. And so a lot of the physical stuff that communities do together is sort of, it all becomes a little abstract. And, you know, a lot of people think, you know, when we're done all this, we're going to switch more life to online and we'll be content with Zoom. I just don't think that's going to happen. I just feel the amount of emotional pleasure, spiritual pleasure we get from each other's company is going to cause us to want to just embrace mass rock concerts and mass celebrations as soon as we possibly can. I just don't think human nature is going to be changed by this.
Yeah, I mean, I should say that one of the challenges of being on the Orthodox side of things and the more observant side of things is you can't do Zoom on the Sabbath or a holiday because you're not using technology. And but there's still lots and lots of walking around and talking from a safe social distance, at least to some extent. I'm speaking with David Brooks. He is the author of The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. You have been very sympathetic to traditional religion. That comes across very strongly in the book. So my question is, what's going to change for American religion as we come out of this? And for American politics, yeah, we have to talk about that too, and the polarization of the country. 1-800-955-1776 with David Brooks of the New York Times.
The Michael Medved Show, michaelmedved.com.
to columnist, journalist David Brooks, whose book, The Second Mountain, has changed people's lives and on its way to achieving a status as the number one bestseller in the country. I should explain, David, that The Second Mountain presupposes a first mountain. And the first mountain you define as basically success, the way that most people see it, building a life, building a career, enjoying some kind of financial reward for what you're doing. So what is the second mountain that people do feel that they need to climb after they've finished with the first one?
It's not even, you don't have to have success. I think most of us start our lives, get out of school, and we have certain dreams. And they tend to be the dreams of the ego. We want to, and that's normal and necessary. You want to establish your place in the world. You want to get some sort of reputation. You want to make a difference in the world. And I think what happens is one of three things. One is you set out in the world and you do achieve success. And when you get to the top of it, you find it a lot less satisfying than you thought you would. I remember, you know, all my life I've wanted to be a writer, and I remember the first time I got a call that I had a bestseller. And I thought it would be like a great moment, but it just felt like nothing. It just felt like, yeah, something happening out there. It doesn't really affect me. And so I think a lot of people achieve what their dreams and they find it unsatisfying. Or second, maybe you fail and you're no longer on the mountain and you're in a moment of suffering. Life just hasn't worked out the way you thought it would. Or third, something hits you that wasn't part of the original plan. You get a cancer scare, you get a loss of a child, some horrible thing. And so in each case, for different reasons, you're sort of in the valley and you're in a moment of suffering, which is sort of like the moment we're in now. And I read in the book, I quote a theologian named Paul Tillich, who says that suffering interrupts your life and tells you you're not the person you thought you were. And it carves into the floor of the basement of your soul, and it reveals a cavity below, and it carves into the floor of that and reveals a cavity below. You just see depths of yourself you didn't see before. And when you look into those depths, you realize that only really spiritual and relational food will fill those cavities. And so you get a little revolution of the ego, and your ego gets crushed. And I do think for a lot of us, certainly for me, it took a moment in the valley to sort of knock my ego upside the head. And then you're ready for a larger life. And there are still lots of things you have to go through. There's spiritual discipline. There's finding yourself. There's the actual act of making commitments. But I do think then you're ready for a larger life. And I will say one thing that has surprised me is how many people, when I was on book tour talking about the book, how many people found their life falling into that pattern. And a lot of people are in the valley at all, and so many people came up to me, especially guys. I think women have counselors and people they can go to during the dark times, but there are a lot of guys who have nobody to go to. And I could set up a CEO whispering service if I wanted to, because all these business, successful business to me and saying, hey, can I have a phone relationship with you? Because I'm going through stuff I have nobody to talk to. And there's just a lot of hurt in America. And then a lot of people who come out the other side. And the book is really sort of a description of the people who've come out the other side and how they did it and what's important to it.
What do you think are the most important factors to allow the country to come out of the side, on the other side? Because this is certainly, when you talk about looking into the depths, and you cite Paul Tillich and taking a look at just the awful situation. 36 million people all across the country have lost their jobs. I mean, lives are upset. Even people who've recovered from this pandemic are feeling changed, altered, sometimes physiologically changed, because it does sometimes do permanent damage. What does the country need to keep in mind to come out right on the other side?
Yeah, I would say the first thing, obviously, the economy has to recover. We have to get back to life and to restore the dignity of work. Second, I think we're going to have a renegotiation of power structures. One of the things that struck me is how local this pandemic is. It hits some place and then not another, and some place early, another place late. And the responses have been local in nature. and they've been successful. And local mayors and state governors have, you know, ratings in the 80 percentile of approval across lines. And I think when we think of pandemics and big national crises, we sometimes think, oh, well, World War II is our model here. The federal government organizes everything. The federal government does everything. We sit back and watch. That's not the world we live in anymore. We don't really trust the center anymore. Young people don't trust some faraway removed people in Washington. And so I'm beginning to see a renegotiation of power and a spread of a new kind of localism where we can recruit ourselves. And the final thing, I think there's just been a shift in values so far. The people who had the success, you know, there was for a time in this society, there was like one definition of success. You got really good grades in high school. You went to an Ivy League college. You got a white-collar job at Goldman Sachs. And that was a success. And everybody else was sort of outside the circle. And now that doesn't seem true at all anymore. And there are a lot more avenues to success and prestige and leading a respectable life. And if we can sort of expose the lies of the meritocracy, that would be a good thing.
Yeah, it's kind of, isn't it interesting, in New York City, I know because our daughter lives in New York City, they still are doing every 7 p.m., people come out and bang pots and pans and holler and cheer and applaud. They're not applauding for the people who are going into work making the Dow go up 500 points. They're applauding the people who are nurses and medical technicians and doctors and firemen and cops and the people who are there in the essential services. When you talked before about the dignity of work, that is likely to enhance, particularly the dignity of service jobs, don't you think?
Yeah, and the caring professions, I mean, the ones that really are central now and I think actually are the growth professions of the future, the healthcare. I worry a lot about the future of education. I think a lot of kids, they're really getting no education right now. Summer camps are closed. Parents are fraught. And so we're going to have to focus a lot on sort of rejiggering the educational system in this country and sort of especially the kids who are at disadvantage of helping them catch up. And those are the jobs that it's not all about how you did on the SAT. It's what kind of human being are you? And I do think, you know, I think we all knew we got over cognitive, and my view we've had this shift of our country got out of alignment, and we were too cognitive when we should have been more emotional. We were too materialistic when we should have been more spiritual. We were too individualistic when we should have been more communal. And this at least is a pause. This is a chance.
Okay,
to have
and
a
what is that? What is that pause? What is that change going to mean for our politics? You may have noticed there's a presidential election coming up. Is our politics keeping pace with this scaling of the second mountain? We will get to that and much more with David Brooks. Your calls, if you want, at 1-800-955-1776. David Brooks, very well known as a commentator everywhere, for the Wall Street Journal previously, for the Washington Times previously, for National Review. Now for the New York Times, he's the author of Bobos in Paradise, The Social Animal, The Road to Character, and most recently now the number one bestseller, The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. David, we're talking about changes in American life, and they are profound. But despite the fact that Congress came together nearly unanimously, except for Tom Massie, to vote for massive, massive relief bills in the Congress, despite that, our politics seems as nasty and polarized as ever? Or do you think those who think that, as I do, are missing something?
Well, it's hard to say how bad our politics is. I saw a study just a few hours ago, how many people would enjoy if the other members of the other party just died. And it's like 20% of each party would like it if the other party died, and like 10% think violence is justified. That's pretty nasty. I think the one saving grace for this country is a lot of us aren't that political. If you ask us a political question, we'll give you a political answer. But a lot of people, their personal identity is not made up of politics. For some people it is, and I think that's frankly a mistake. I think politics is a competition between partial truths. Politics is a way of deliberating over our problems, our shared national problems. But 90% of life is not about politics. It's about relationship. It's about faith. It's about work. It's about your character. And if you're basing your whole identity on your political affiliation, it seems to me you're asking more of politics than politics can give you. And so I think what gives me some cause for hope is if you can get people to not think with the political lens, but think with the more human lens, you can get them to agree across party lines. When I look at how people are reacting to the pandemic, they're seeing past politics. And they're thinking about health, they're thinking about their family, they're thinking about their circles of concern. And whatever happens on the national stage is something that is happening in a remote country far away.
There was a survey that I covered yesterday on the air, a very controversial survey from the Gallup together with the Knight organization, where it showed that a very high percentage of Republicans, about 40% actually of all Republicans, believe that the coronavirus statistics, that the numbers are overstated, that the pandemic is not as severe as it's made out. What do you think that says about the fact that people are not seeing things through a political lens? Because when I see that and compare it to independents and Democrats who almost universally think this is a more serious matter, what I see is politics as a distorting lens through which to view all of this.
Yeah, if you look at the thing that's really leapt out at me, if you ask people, are we over the worst of it or not? And something like 85, 90% of Republicans say, yeah, we're over the hump. We're over, the worst of it is behind us. But something like 85 or 90% of Democrats say the worst is still ahead of us. And so they're taking a much more pessimistic view and Republicans more optimistic. And I think that's entirely because we have a Republican president. If we had a Democratic president, it would be absolutely the opposite. So in some ways, our party label, is shaped by how we see the world and how we answer certain questions. But if you look at behavior, you get like 77% of the country support the social distancing or opening rules that are in their area. When we were really shut down, 77-80% supported the shutdown. If you look at behavior, you can use cell phones to track who's moving and who's not. And the movement of in red states and blue states is pretty much the same. Like actual behavior is pretty much the same. And if you look at who's, handling the things successfully, there's really no correlation between red and blue states. The blue states were obviously hit harder in the beginning because they're more crowded. But, if you look at the ones who are sort of flattening the curve, there's some blue states, there's some red states. I think Tennessee, Indiana have done very well. And so if you look at the behavior, a lot of that red-blue breaks down. But it's still very, very much a category in people's minds, which you can cue by asking them the right questions.
What do you think has to change in our politics? I mean, right now, your newspaper, the New York Times, has been reporting on a lot of worries that however this election turns out, it's going to be rejected by many Americans. President Trump is already talking. He tweeted last night about a rigged election. I mean, already. The question about the very legitimacy of our elections seems to be in trouble. How does that relate to the kind of communal, neighborly, you can almost say love of your countrymen, not just love of your country in the abstract. How does that idea that we may not even be able to have a normal election this time with a decided result that is accepted by everybody, how do you change that? How do you fix it?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you one thing that has upset me. I'm not a supporter of President Trump's. I'm not a fan. But, you know, it's been worrying me my whole adult life. I started in the university, and the people who would support Trump were sort of pushed out by social pressure from the universities like 30 or 40 years ago, and then pushed out of the media over the last 30 or 40 years. If you look at the coastal nonprofits, no Trump supporters. And so if you tell 42% of the country, hey, we're not including you, your voice isn't here, they're going to react, and they're going to react with intense distrust. And so I think we reaped the whirlwind by excluding a lot of people. And
that using terms like the deplorables.
Exactly. And so when this, I don't think it's possible right now in this election climate to sort of have some actual cultural integration in our institutions, but I think it's essential after this election is over, and that people who feel invisible, feel left out, people that don't feel seen, they get a voice too, and we're going to sit next to you in the office, and we're going to sit next to you in the newspaper, and we're going to read your columns and listen to your shows. And to me, unless we can actually have some human contact with each other, that level of distrust, that feeling that everything is somehow rigged, that's just going to persist. And it's a grassroots thing that has to happen. It's not going to be imposed from the top down.
And conspiracy theories, one of the reasons people look for their popularity is because they can create a sense of empowerment, because you all of a sudden have privileged information about what is secretly going on. When we come back, I want to talk about conspiracy theories, how to counter them, how the agenda of climbing that second mountain, the mountain of more meaning, more community, more relationships, more transcendence, how the idea of vast conspiracies that work against the public interest violates the basic needs that David Brooks is writing about. His book is called The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. And it also includes a great deal of material about his finding new value in religious teaching. That and more coming up on The MedVed Show with David Brooks.
Michael MedVed.
More with David Brooks. His book is called The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. It has been a number one bestseller. And for many people, it seems particularly relevant as America's looking for a second life after life opens up again and we get back to somewhere like normal. And David, I know that you share with me a great admiration for our country and for what our country is about and the way that we stand out, remain an exceptional nation, an indispensable nation in the world at large. How would you explain to someone the idea of America as the greatest nation in the world? And yet, we're not the worst when it comes to the coronavirus and the way it's hit us and the way it's damaged our economy. There are countries that have suffered far more than we have. But we're very far from the best. Why are we just in the middle of the pack when it comes to coronavirus response?
Yeah, I would say there's, well, first of all, I agree with you about this country being great, as you say, the greatest country on God's green earth. And I, you know, my family story is just another illustration of so many stories of people who escaped oppression, came here and found a promised land. I would say there's some things our culture makes us pretty good at and some things it doesn't make us pretty good at. I spoke with a University of Maryland social psychologist named Michelle Gelfond a couple of days ago, and she wrote a book on loose and tight cultures. And she said certain countries that were invaded a lot or had a lot of disease, a lot of pathogens, they became at following rules. And they are what she calls tight cultures. They follow rules. They're good at acting in unison. They're a little less creative than other countries, but they're really good at responding to threats because they've been threatened so many times over the course of their history. Other countries, which she calls loose countries, haven't been invaded that much, haven't been attacked by disease all that much. And so they're less good at following rules. They're rule breakers. They're loose cultures. They like a little individual creativity, a little nonconformity, a little rebellion against authority. And America is a classic loose culture. And it makes us super creative and super dynamic. And we're really good at setting up like Silicon Valley, a big innovation center. But when a threat hits, we just have less practice and we're less good at it. So each culture, you know, so some countries like Germany or Austria or South Korea or Singapore, they're really good at moving as one and following rules. Other countries like Brazil and us and, you know, Australia, not so good. And so I just think our culture bias is against super organized action all at once, the way some other countries, which other countries are good at.
I think it's very perceptive and very profound about America. And of course, having a loose culture where there is more of a creative rebellious spark is part of what makes America great and exceptional and so much worth defending. Something that it seems to me is indefensible is the resort to conspiratorial thinking, especially at a time like this. And let me mention two conspiracy theories that are all very popular, one on the left and one on the right. The one on the left, your colleague in the Times, Paul Krugman, had a piece recently that was titled by the newspaper, Dying for the Dow. And the implication being that evil Republicans and their evil, evil Christian evangelical allies are so fixated on getting Trump reelected that they will do anything and sacrifice grandma and throw her off a cliff and destroy people's lives just to keep the Dow Jones gaining. I spoke yesterday to an economist, Jerry Boyer, who I think made the point that, look, if all of a sudden there are thousands more people dying, that's not good news in any sense for the stock market or the economy. On the other side, you have all these people, and I'm sure you hear from them all the time, who believe this entire thing is a gigantic hoax, and it was kicked up by the infamous liberal establishment to get Trump de-elected. What do you say about the general popularity right now of conspiratorial thinking? Seems to be a toxic theme in our culture at the moment.
Yeah, you know, the first thing I always say, and it never persuades anybody, is like, my job as a journalist is to hang around people in, at the center of power and know what they're thinking. And so I've spent my life interviewing people. And my general rule is people at the center of, at the top of society are not smart enough to pull off a conspiracy. They're just not. and if they did, it would leak immediately. Because nobody can really keep a secret. So I almost never believe conspiracies just because I've seen how it works and it's not that efficient. Second, I think conspiracy flows out of distrust. And, you know, I used to cover the Middle East and just intense distrust of everybody over there. And so everybody believes these conspiracies, the protocols of the elders of Zion and that kind of thing. And now we've got a lot of distrust in this country. And when you get distrust, people distrusting each other, people distrusting the institutions of society, then conspiracy theories are a way to explain things. And as you say, they're a way to make yourself feel really good because you're so smart, because you understand it. And they're a way to have a defined evil that these people are causing that. But in general, sometimes there's a defined evil. Sometimes you just find yourself in a situation that's really hard. And this pandemic is that kind of situation. It's not Republicans are trying to boost the Dow. They're trying to keep people's livelihoods. And we're in a situation where there are two rival goods, and that's a common thing in life, where there's the good of safety and then the good of the economy, and we're trying to find a balance. And there's no one answer for this country. Each individual area has their own context, and they'll find their right answer. But to say that all lockdown is good or no lockdown is good, that strikes me as just silly. It's finding the right balance between the two goods that we're chasing at the same time.
What do you think is the most crucial element to, you talked about the breakdown of trust, the distrust, the positive hatred, the 20% of Americans wish people in the other party would just die. I was struck, I know you were, you wrote about it, I'm pretty sure, David. I remember reading a column you wrote where people are less likely to sanction, they're more likely to sanction marrying someone from another religion than they are marrying someone from another political party, which is kind of stunning. What do we do to try to break down some of the partisan rancor?
Yeah, I really am focused on this issue of trust. If for the World War II generation, they had this experience when they were young, and they went through the rest of their lives with this sense that the country is good, that we show up for each other, and that you can trust the people around you. With every succeeding generation, that level of trust has gone down. And now if you look at people under 35, 65% say most people cannot be trusted. 74% say most people are selfish and only looking out for themselves. And so they're going to experience this pandemic, and they're either going to confirm that level of distrust, or they'll think, well, we did actually show up for each other. Most people can be trusted. And the thing about your attitudes towards society, they're very much formed by the time you're 30. And then when you're 30, you pretty much carry them for the rest of your life. And so to me, it's super important that young adults and teenagers see a positive outcome of this. And they come to believe they live in a country they can be intensely proud of. And I'm really focusing on that. And then the final thing I'll say is, you know, my job, at least before the pandemic, was to travel. I was in three states a week, most weeks. I just did a lot of travel, a lot of interviewing. And I spent a lot of time in red states and a lot of time in blue states. And I met all sorts of people. And I really think we're more divided on the media level than we are in real life.
And I think that is emphatically the case. And that is certainly one of the messages that comes across very clearly in The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. Its author is David Brooks. It has been a joy speaking to you, David, again. And congratulations on the success of the book. It is posted at our website at michaelmedved.com. In the 15 seconds that we have left to us, what's your next book?
I'm doing a book on the art of seeing others and being deeply seen, how we get to know another human being really well.
Well, I will look forward to getting to know that book really well. Coming up on the Michael Medved Show, we'll be talking about a moment in American history where big government confronted big business in a pretty brawling and bruising way. But thanks to inspired leadership, the country came out of it better. How? We'll tell you that part of the story of this greatest nation on God's green earth.